Mark Sobel, U.S. Chair, OMFIF. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Andreas Lehnert for a fireside chat. Andreas is a longtime member of the Federal Reserve Board's first-rate staff and is now Director of the Financial Stability Division. Before assuming that role in 2016, Andreas had been Deputy Director in the division, which was founded in 2010. Andreas is known globally for his work on financial vulnerabilities, macroprudential policy, and a wealth of other topics. So welcome, Andreas. You and your team prepare the Federal Reserve Semiannual Financial Stability Report. You just released the latest report 2 weeks ago. First of all, I want to praise the Fed for doing this report. I think it's an excellent read. It's an outstanding contribution to transparency. And the issues highlighted are extraordinarily important to the U.S. economy and our financial system. Many countries have been doing them for a while. You were a bit late to the party. How did you arrive at the decision to launch the report?
Thank you for those very kind words about the Fed's financial stability report. I'll come back to, you know, why we launched it more recently, but I think, you know, it's useful to go back actually as you mentioned, you know, the division that I head is celebrating its 10th birthday this month. And, you know, we started writing these reports internally and I would say more broadly, thinking through a structured framework for analyzing financial stability in that 2009-2010 period, you know, at a time when we were coming out of the financial crisis and, you know, we realized that, you know, a lot of things needed to change. One of the post-crisis reforms was the Dodd-Frank Act, I think something we're going to talk more about over the course of this conversation. And it required the, you know, created this new entity, the FSOC, the Financial Stability Oversight Council, and gave the FSOC certain responsibilities, among them writing a financial stability report every year. And, you know, obviously, there were certain statutory requirements that that report had to meet. I think those of us active in financial stability at the Fed, along with, you know, all of the other member agencies of the FSOC, were pretty focused, you know, in terms of public communications on making sure that that, you know, FSOC annual report was right. And in addition, of course, I should also say that the Dodd-Frank Act created the Office of Financial Research, which also published it was required to publish a financial stability report. At the time, sort of in the early years of that sort of post-crisis period, it felt like there was no shortage of public financial stability reports, you know, coming out of the U.S. government. So, you know, at the same time, internally inside the Fed, we were evolving our own kind of understanding and structure of how to think about financial vulnerabilities. And that, you know, matured and, Fed policymakers became, I think much more comfortable talking about financial stability and how it, you know, fit together with the Fed's responsibilities and actions. So when Chair Powell took the helm, you know, he made transparency, you know, a hallmark of his leadership of the Fed. And so he and Governor Brainard, I think, felt that, you know, the time was right to, you know, to enhance the transparency of the Fed and its communications, to sort of explain to the public a basic set of facts around financial stability. The report is designed to provide kind of a common set of facts, a platform that individual policymakers can refer to when they're explaining their own thinking about how financial stability fits into their own thinking about, you know, kind of policy matters.
Well, thank you for that. So your reports are based on a four-part framework. Would you like to just briefly outline what the four parts are and why those?
You know, that was part of the evolution of our thinking that we were sort of coming to over the last decade. The four parts, I divide them into, you know, sort of two major categories. You've got your classic macro financial imbalances, you know, asset valuations, borrowing by businesses and households, and then you've two factors that really speak to the resilience of the financial system. So the solvency of major financial institutions and then funding risks in the system. So kind of imbalances between the liquidity of assets and liabilities of parts of the financial system. So, you know, why did we pick those? I mean, I think there's like a pretty good body of academic research that suggests that, you know, asset valuations, or if you will, financial conditions, are an important kind of forward-looking indicator of economic conditions. And, you know, in particular, what we're trying to get at, this is, you know, an evolution of the somewhat older debate over whether, you know, asset prices are too high, or if there's a bubble underway. And instead, it casts, essentially, we're casting that debate in terms of, do the risk premiums that people are demanding when they purchase an asset, do those look unusually low by historical standards? And when they tend to, that's something to look at, you know, work by Tobias and Tobias Adrian and others, you know, has demonstrated that there is this like very interesting property that when those risk premia are compressed, that you know, you see sort of good news in the near term, but potentially bad news in the long term. And Tobias has demonstrated, you know, that the left tail gets a little fatter of GDP outcomes. Borrowing by businesses and households, you know, this is something that I think goes back at least to, you know, the paper by Claudio Borio and Bill White in 2003, demonstrating that when you have a credit, you know, at the time they didn't use, I think, the term credit boom, but when you had credit growing faster than income persistently, that economic growth was subpar, kind of going ahead to the expected, you know, the expected path for GDP would be below normal or below trend. And of course, you know, the experience of the mortgage credit boom of the 2000s in the United States and the subsequent bust, you know, was really sort of very tangible proof of that kind of thing. And then there's been an enormous amount of work since then by Schulerich and Taylor and others looking at, you know, credit booms. So, you know, that's, I think, the sort of strong intellectual underpinnings for the kind of imbalances part of it. And then the resilience of the financial system is really predicated on the question that, or on the view that, we're not going to be able to stop bad things from happening. It's not really, it's not our job. It's not, it's, you know, things like the pandemic, it's not even really possible. And so instead, you want to ask, you know, do we have a financial system that can take the shock and absorb it rather than amplifying it? And, you know, the classic amplification channels are things like credit crunches, when the banking system isn't sufficiently well capitalized and, causes a deeper economic contraction than would have otherwise been the case. Or, you know, in the case of funding risk, some of these very fast burn, very rapidly moving bank run style dynamics that can occur outside of the banking system in particular.
And we'll certainly delve into that a little bit. But since you just wrote the report and you just outlined the framework, what does it look like right now? What did your report find?
Well, it's definitely available on our website. I commend it to everyone to go look at. I won't go through the report in detail, but maybe I'll just hit a couple of the sort of high points. I'll talk about where we sort of landed on the four vulnerabilities in a second, but you know, with so much that's happened this year, the report has like some special topic boxes where we address, you know, some of the notable events. So that includes, you know, a pretty deep discussion of the Fed's emergency lending facilities, a deep dive on the turmoil that we saw in Treasury and mortgage-backed security markets in March and April, an update on the transition away from LIBOR. We have a survey that we conduct, that actually the New York Fed conducts, of market participants, where we ask about, you know, salient shocks that they're focused on. And so that's a routine part of our report where we sort of give a readout on that. And then we have a box on the role of climate change, kind of explaining how that fits into our financial stability assessment. I do think that the discussion of our emergency lending facilities is particularly worth having a look at. And, you know, let me just focus on the part of the box that looked at, you know, the really novel emergency lending facilities, the ones that were designed to make sure that credit markets that were, you know, relied upon by employers were functioning, right? So in March and April, we saw a lot of dysfunction in corporate bond, muni markets, asset-backed security markets. And so when we think about the waterfront of employers that are out there, state and local governments, small, medium-sized businesses, large corporations, you know, issuers of asset-backed securities, like in principle, there was a backstop facility to make sure that the markets they faced off against were working. So did these, so that's how we came up with, I think, four broad groups of facilities, the Muni facility, the Main Street lending facility, the corporate credit facilities in Calf. So did they work? So as we describe in our report, there were powerful announcement effects. But the total amount of lending was relatively, at least so far, has been relatively limited at just at $24 billion across those, you know, four groups of facilities. But usage is kind of the wrong way to gauge the success of those facilities. Their backstops, you know, they assure market participants that market conditions aren't going to become so dislocated that borrowers are totally frozen out, kind of forced into kind of a technical default. The actual use has to be compared against, you know, the real measure of success is the nearly $2 trillion in corporate muni, ABS, syndicated loans that are being issued, you know, since the market's nadir in late March. Turning to, you know, the state of vulnerabilities, the four vulnerabilities, I won't go through those. Let me just pick out one that I think was interesting pre-crisis or pre-pandemic, and it's certainly been quite interesting through the pandemic, and that is the level of business debt. So borrowing by businesses, you know, whether you measured it relative to, you know, business income or business assets, was quite high and in the tails, you know, potentially record high levels amid, you know, signs of deteriorating underwriting standards. So on our radar screen was, you know, discussed extensively in, you know, in all of the reports that we've published since we started in November 2018. So over the course of this year, business debt has jumped significantly because businesses needed to borrow to get through, you know, the pandemic-related shutdowns, declines in income. This was actually like a very appropriate thing for them to be doing. Businesses need to maintain capacity for the, you know, eventual economic recovery, and we wanted to avoid the deadweight cost, the permanent scarring that comes with the loss of organizational, you know, capital and understanding from business failure. Nonetheless, if you look at the graph, there's a fairly dramatic jump, which it's sort of one of those truisms in financial stability that when you see, you know, things that look like hockey sticks, it's one of those things that raises alarm bells. A big part of that jump was due in part to Paycheck Protection Program lending. Somewhere between $500 and $600 billion were lent out in a relatively short amount of time. That's a type of loan that can be forgiven. In addition, it looks like businesses took out some precautionary borrowing to put cash on their balance sheets, you know, in case, you know, I think just because having cash to meet unusual demands was probably seen as a good idea by a lot of business managers. So if you look at debt, you know, netting out cash on the balance sheet, the increase there is not as large. In fact, actually ticked down, you know, most recently. And of course, you have to keep in mind that interest rates have fallen substantially, making all of this debt a lot more affordable. But this is definitely something to keep an eye on. I think we're probably going to talk a lot more about elements of the financial system going forward. I imagine you have some questions about the non-bank sector. So let me just very briefly say that, you know, our evaluation of the resilience of the financial system looks like banks really took the shock and were, you know, able to meet the, you know, very dramatic demand for, you know, draws on lines of credit and borrowing by corporations. And certainly for those of us who are veterans of the 2008 experience, it was a source of comfort not to have to manage, you know, a set of insolvent institutions. And then in funding markets, you know, obviously there were major problems with money market funds and, you know, in certain markets as well. Probably talk about that more.
Well, great. Thank you for that. So let's dig into some of these issues. Well, let me start very big. So the Fed has a dual mandate of price stability and maximum employment. I didn't hear the words financial stability in that. Yet, as we know, adverse financial events can disrupt the real economy severely. And that's, I think, especially true now at a time for lower for longer interest rates where there's a tremendous search for yield. So it's said that monetary policy should be directed at the dual mandate, financial stability risk. It said, well, you know, micro and especially macroprudential regulation can play a role in tackling these and even give space to monetary policy. So U.S. bank microprudential regulation is generally seen as sound, and we weathered the crisis. The banks have weathered the crisis so far decently enough. But on macroprudential policy, if I were being charitable about the United States, I'd say it's still evolving. You know, and your wonderful predecessor, Nellie Lange, has written about how the U.S. doesn't have the same wealth of macroprudential policies as other countries. It's especially true in housing with loan. We don't have loan to values and debt to income ratios and things like that. So you were alluding this to, and I've been through a lot of this. I've been through the Asia crisis, LTCM, 9/11, the Great Recession, the taper tantrum, COVID. Should financial stability considerations be accorded more weight in central bank processes and thinking? And I'll provocatively say, including the Federal Reserve. And the Bank of England has a financial policy council. It includes the wonderful Don Cohn, who we both know. I mean, could such a structure be a useful addition for the Federal Reserve?
Mark, I mean, there are a lot of different ways to, you know, to think about how to promote financial stability. I mean, I think what I would say is that, I guess I'll put in a plug for a paper of mine from a few years ago, and this was with co-authors Doug Elliott and Greg Felberg. You know, I looked at the history of macroprudential policymaking in the United States because, you know, you pointed out that the United States lacks, you know, the macroprudential tools that many other countries, you know, have, such as minimum down payment requirements on housing. But the reality is that the United States government or arms of the United States government used to have, you know, those sorts of authorities. And in fact, the United States used to pursue like a very active program of what we would now call macroprudential policymaking. Of course, the paper goes back to the 19 teens, the early 20th century, you know, gosh, 100 years ago now. But I mean, really, this sort of picks up in the 1930s, 1940s, 50s, you know, in the 60s, and then the 1980 sort of credit rationing, where the Fed limited the amount of borrowing that households could do on their credit cards, and kind of the final macroprudential policy that we were able to find in our database was in the early 1990s. There was a coordinated attempt at what we would call macroprudential easing, where all the banking agencies kind of coordinated a reduction in deposit in reserve requirements, and as an attempt to kind of counteract the credit crunch of the early 90s. So, you know, what was our takeaway from all of that? There's just no getting around the political complexities of getting involved in markets that are facing consumers. You know, that's reality in the United States in the 1940s and 50s, and it's reality, I'm sure, in every jurisdiction that you know, that practices this. In terms of evaluating the success of those policies, they succeeded in the sense of the idea was that they were attempts to control credit growth. But whether or not that actually promoted financial stability is still kind of an open question. If there's some kind of underlying credit, you know, some kind of underlying financial imbalance that's producing a credit boom, and you shut off one particular form of credit, it's not clear that that doesn't, you know, emerge in some other format. I think we'll learn a lot from, you know, how other countries experience with these things over time. But sort of coming back to the United States, I'd say that the emphasis was in the post-crisis environment on less in the way of cyclical tools, you know, tools that you're going to adjust over the course of the financial cycle, and much, much more on just building the kind of core resilience of the system, and just putting a lot of emphasis on really high and credible capital levels, liquidity levels, and so forth.
Financial Policy Council, would that be a good addition?
There's a lot of ways to do this. I mean, I think, you know, the structure is certainly very logical, but, you know, on the other hand, the Bank of England has both authority and accountability for a lot more, you know, than the Fed does. So that's, it's a sort of decision ultimately for Congress how it wants to arrange the authority and the associated accountability.
you know, the global financial crisis exposed huge weaknesses in our financial oversight system. I think between Dodd-Frank and the efforts made to strengthen bank capital and liquidity while reducing leverage, our banks are in much better shape, and you discussed that earlier. I mean, I think there's still, you can have debates about stress tests and dividend policies and whatnot. It doesn't change the bottom line that the banks seem to be in much better shape, though that doesn't mean there isn't more that could be done. In March, as the pandemic was breaking out, we saw enormous turmoil in financial markets, you know, treasury markets, repo, corporate, muni bonds, ETFs, and other areas. Many of them were beyond the Fed's supervisory remit. And as you mentioned, we saw prime money market funds become a flashpoint once again. So to restore stability to financial markets, the Fed had to haul out not only its 2009 playbook, the Bernanke playbook, but you had to go far beyond it this time. And it showed again that financial market reverberations can hurt the Fed's ability to achieve its mandate. So I have a two-part question for you. The first is there more on macroprudential policy with respect to the banks? In that regard, the Fed's debated using the countercyclical buffer. It's at zero. You haven't really used it, though. Okay, and then the second question is really more about the non-bank financial intermediation risks. Does America need to do more on non-bank financial intermediation?
So, you know, you kind of skipped over it a little bit, but let me just emphasize again, you know, the microprudential victory here was, you know, absolutely key. It was an enormous relief not having to manage major insolvent financial institutions in the midst of the pandemic breaking out. You know, and as I said earlier, you know, the emphasis in the United States has been on structural rather than cyclical resilience. And no doubt, I think this was an opportunity to learn about the system under stress. And, you know, there's no doubt going to be some thinking about the issues like the usability of buffers and so forth that would bear on the mix of cyclical versus structural. But I think that sort of the big, you know, the big takeaway is that the post-crisis system of, you know, capital liquidity stress testing really, you know, did its job and delivered a banking system that was able to absorb like a relatively large shock. Turning to the non-bank financial system, I like to think of there as being, you know, there's this market ecosystem, and there isn't really a clean margin between banks and non-banks. You know, the reality is that, you know, in the U.S., banks, particularly the largest, are critical parts of this what a lot of people refer to as a non-bank ecosystem, because the sort of broker-dealers, the subsidiaries of the big holding companies. And we actually draw this out in the financial stability report. You know, we draw out some of the connections between banks and non-banks through lines of credit and kind of other mechanisms. So as you say, there's a lot of disruptions in certain parts of the ecosystem. You know, you mentioned the kind of second run on prime money funds, and that required for the second time in 12 years a taxpayer funded backstop, right? So the runs on the money funds were stopped by an emergency lending facility that was able to, you know, make loans, you know, collateralized by the assets of these funds, which had some credit risk in them because it had a slice of equity provided by the Treasury Department to backstop losses. There were stresses in open-end mutual funds that were not as severe, didn't require the same, you know, level of response. You know, I think that's a, you know, set of issues that I'm sure is on the agenda at the Securities and Exchange Commission for study and reform. A big part of the kind of market disruptions in March, you know, had to do with Treasury and MBS markets. Our financial stability report, you know, has a discussion of that, you know, going through kind of the major entities, you know, that were involved in that market, the kind of global reserve managers, hedge funds, you know, the dealer community, principal trading firms, and others, and just sort of, you know, thinking through, you had this essentially a large amount of very rapid selling for a variety of reasons, and a limited capacity to absorb all of that selling. I think with that kind of framing, you can think about sort of a helpful framing to think about, you know, how to avoid a repeat of that kind of, that kind of event. You have, on the one hand, what were the forces that were driving the extreme demand for liquidity? On the other hand, what were the forces that perhaps limited the capacity of the system to absorb selling? And so you can, you can think about changes that would decrease the demand for emergency liquidity and changes that could increase the supply of emergency liquidity.
You know, one of the great joys I had at Treasury was I was the ES Exchange Stabilization Fund manager. So I'm very familiar with money market fund guarantees and have some scars to show for that. Continuing then with non-bank financial intermediation oversight, as you just alluded to, a lot of that has to do with other agencies such as the SEC. Dodd-Frank created the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which is a council of regulators chaired by the Treasury, feds included. And it has monitoring responsibilities, and it has the power to designate systemically important entities. Now, such entity designations may work for banks and financial market utilities, but it's been argued that regulatory approaches for banks will not necessarily work for non-banks, and that the FSOC should focus on non-bank financial intermediation activities, such as leverage and interconnectedness rather than entities. I'd say based on what happened in March, as you discuss in the financial stability report, a possible conclusion citizens could draw is that the FSOC has not been successfully doing its job. I also remember a letter from Bernanke, Yellen, and Geithner and Liu criticizing certain FSOC processes in recent years. So while an activities-based approach makes sense to me in theory or in principle, I don't understand how the FSOC concretely implements this. And again, the Fed's a prominent member, and you signed off on the FSOC approach to non-banks. So could you enlighten me on this set of issues, and does the Federal Reserve think the FSOCs need to be more aggressive on non-bank financial intermediation?
Yeah, I mean, the FSOC has a lot of jobs, and one of them is information sharing. I feel duty bound to note the fact that the sort of the key staff committee on kind of systemic risks at the FSOC has been meeting, you know, every week, has been an incredibly productive and important venue for sharing among the agencies over the course of this year. But turning specifically to your question about, you know, the role of the FSOC, non-banks, you know, that large cluster of issues, you know, as you said, designation of large non-bank entities is a potential solution to things that you might call, you know, the AIG problem, where you might have or a Lehman Brothers, you know, where you had like a large systemically important entity that was outside of the prudential umbrella. But then, you know, as the members of the FSOC, many years ago now, you know, sort of in the my recollection is in the 2013-2014 timeframe, you know, thinking through things like asset managers, that kind of, you know, for a variety of reasons, you know, that kind of designation just simply isn't going to work. So instead, you know, at the time, the FSOC said that it was moving towards an activities-based approach. So just a couple of examples. First, you know, the FSOC was heavily engaged with the Securities and Exchange Commission on, you know, the set of reforms that they put in place in 2014 that involved, you know, among other things, the move to a floating net asset value, which was, you know, very helpful. And that was a productive engagement and I think helpful in the cause of a stronger financial system. And then much more recently, the FSOC recently concluded kind of an activities-based review of guarantees or activity liquidity provision in secondary mortgage markets, you know, which considered in some depth the FHFA's capital rule, the threat posed by Fannie and Freddie to financial stability. But again, I think that was a case of members of the FSOC coming together on kind of a difficult issue and, you know, putting our heads together and working through a difficult and complex set of issues, you know, bringing a kind of a financial stability perspective to some of these thorny questions.
Okay, well, let me Let me continue in this vein and ask my most provocative questions, which is the Financial Stability Report, as you outlined, has a wonderful analysis of what happened in March and the issues that arose with respect to non-bank financial intermediation. And I guess my question is, does the Financial Stability Report owe it to the public to speak out forcefully and tell us what the Fed is going to do about it? And even if the solution resides outside your institution, what does the Federal Reserve think needs to be done? Because these ructions end up spilling back over to you.
Yes, Mark, as you said, a provocative question indeed. I think the Financial Stability Report's job is to, you know, lay out the sort of the key set of facts on the state of the financial system and its ability to handle shocks. And I think we have a pretty good track record of looking at the whole waterfront of the financial system and identifying those areas where, you know, we think there's a potential amplification that could happen. And that's, you know, this is the Financial Stability Report is not the supervision report, right? It is not, it's not devoted to, you know, just the parts of the financial system that the Fed oversees and is accountable for. So previous financial stability reports, you know, have identified potential amplification mechanisms, run risks, you know, in money funds, even after the reforms that have been put in place. There's all the major sectors of the financial system that play out are discussed from the perspective of their ability to absorb rather than amplify shocks. That's the job of the Financial Stability Report, and I give us a pretty good grade for doing that.
Let me go back to praising you. The last report had a foreword from Leo Brainard on climate risks and a good discussion of that. I welcome it. I also want to commend the Fed for finally seeking to join the Network for the Greening of the Financial System. I actually put out a tweet on that and somebody wrote me back, what does climate have to do with monetary policy? I'm sure you get that question. I told them about stranded assets and like. But are climate finance risks playing an increased role in the Fed's work, its assessments, and do you expect this to be a much greater focus of Fed work going forward? And do you have any thoughts for us on that?
So let me just start with what Chair Powell recently said. You know, he pointed out after the last FOMC press conference that, you know, I do think the public will expect and has every right to expect that in our oversight of the financial system, we'll account for all material risks and try to protect the economy and the public from those risks. Climate change is one of those risks, right? So our box, it's obviously entirely consistent with that statement. You know, we get a question a lot, how does climate change fit into your financial stability framework? And the, you know, the box is an attempt to explain how that, you know, to answer that question, right? Climate change results in, obviously, in acute and chronic physical risks, you know, hurricanes, pluvial flooding, one of my new favorite words, you know, desertification and so on. So all of these, you know, result in, you know, very obvious damage to property and other physical assets. Then associated with that, there's also the potential for assets to be abruptly repriced, you know, if they're exposed to these risks. So, you know, the reality is that markets can be fairly nonlinear when it comes, especially when it comes to novel risks. And the sort of the general thinking on climate change is relatively new. So, you know, public perceptions can change quickly. And, you know, with that, you can get asset prices moving around. So, you know, you've got a novel set of shocks. You've got the potential for big moves in asset prices, and all of these things, you know, interact with, you know, the kind of the classic vulnerabilities that we, you know, that we work through in our report. So, you know, debt loads might prove unsustainable, you know, once the dust has settled, you know, after, you know, an abrupt repricing, or that, you know, the asset price moves themselves can have knock-on effects. So, you know, our framework is designed to handle these sorts of things, as I said, but, we're not standing still. You know, the Fed researchers have had an ongoing, you know, an active research agenda on the ways in which the way these effects sort of ramify through the economy. And, you know, obviously that's a, you know, it's an important and growing field in economics generally. You know, but Fed researchers are kind of heavily engaged in all of those things. So there's this, you know, obvious connection to bank supervision. You know, your question about monetary policy, I mean, just as with, you know, financial stability, there's the potential for, you know, some of these, you know, risks and events and potential amplification mechanisms to cause a miss on the dual mandate. So in the same way, you know, it's incumbent to understand that set of risks.
There's no better person on earth to ask this question to. So you must have a secret piece of paper where you list the top 101 risks that could go wrong for the Fed and the U.S. financial system. I'd be shocked if a pandemic hadn't been on your list. I'd be disappointed if you didn't have a list up your sleeves that you won't tell us about. So you can't know the unknown, but what are the big risks out there that keep you up at night?
There's a two-part answer to that, Mark. I mean, you know, absolutely everyone has their list of scary events, but really the job of financial stability, it's not to stop the bad thing from happening. It's to stop the financial system from turning whatever bad event occurs into a much bigger deal, right? And so I think the intellectual value is in thinking through potential additional amplification mechanisms. You know, we've got the set of amplification mechanisms that we're, you know, that we highlight in the report and that we're working through, you know, but the reality is that, you know, there are other ways that, you know, the financial system can turn something relatively, you know, medium sized into a bigger deal. I think that's, yes, one could hypothesize a pandemic, and certainly during the time of the bird flu and when SARS was in headlines, you know, a lot of people were thinking about, gosh, what would this mean? And yet those sorts of analyses didn't really, they were, it's worthwhile. You know, people focused a lot on mortality risks and, you know, life insurance companies and amplification channels through that. That's not really what we've seen. And instead, it's been much more about market functioning, you know, about the sort of dash for cash and real stresses on intermediation capacity. So I think those, you know, thinking through, you know, gosh, what's the role of market liquidity in a well-functioning, resilient financial system? And, you know, what do we need to make sure that it's going to be robust? That's very valuable. In terms of what keeps me up at night, you know, obviously the elevated level of business leverage is something that, you know, we cite in the report as perfectly understandable, perfectly reasonable, but the potential is there, you know, for the potential for some, you know, higher than expected business failures and associated, you know, kind of knock-on effects through the economy.
Well, thank you for this. I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been a great opportunity for your to highlight the invaluable work of your division and the value of the report.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Mark.